from Norwich. It's the quiz of the week. Our star prizes include a dining suite, a television and music center, a pair of watches in gold quartz, the two-door family car, and a selection of bicycles. But let's start with this reproduction Capplewhite-style dining suite in solid mahogany. It's made up of a dining table plus four chairs and two carvers, and the antique price is £120. And now for two items of home entertainment, here's a 20-inch colour television set and a comprehensive music centre on offer for £100. Or you might like our suggestion of two gold quartz watches going for £80. And the family car is once again the popular Mini Metro. This one's in royal blue, has that lively 1,000cc engine that's easy on the fuel, and as usual, it's on offer for £140. This selection of bicycles includes a track and five-speed racer for the energetic, two conventional bikes, and a 12 and six-speed racer for the real enthusiasts. They're all going for £68. And there they are, this week's star attractions that could be offered to our winning contestants tonight. Which will they choose? But now let's meet the man with the questions and the money. Nicholas Parsons.
Nah, it's not Nicholas Parsons. It's time for Chips with Everything, and my name is Quentin. I'm the host of this show, CITR 101.9 FM. You've been listening to, that was Blood on the Saddle, and this is the British music show on CITR, and we play tracks from the UK from whenever we feel like, and of course new stuff. But we're actually going to kick off today's show with a little trip back to the 90s, a popular decade for revivalism right now. Going to start the show off with some Moloko, a bit of Chris Morris, some Dubstar, and then probably the most 90s thing I could come up with, an Alex Gopher remix by the Moog Cookbook. So chill it. Keep listening. You're listening to CITR 101.9. It's Chips with Everything.
Yeah. just so exotic. You look so exotic.
I don't think we'll be able to go to dinner with the Lartons on Friday.
Hey. Why not?
Well, I shot Bob this morning. Bloody duel in the office.
Oh, I rather liked him.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. So did I. Could you get that, love? Probably be Louisa wanting to talk about it. Oh, hang on. It could be Pat Turner.
Why?
Because I shot Miriam.
You shot Miriam?
Well, I was still wired after shooting Bob, and she was walking past, and I just emptied the magazine into that ruddy great back of her.
Oh, bloody hell. Hello?
What am I doing?
Yes, he is. It's the police, love.
Oh, that's a relief.
Yeah, he has been on a bit of a spree. They say you should really be in a cell for a bit.
Well, I know exactly what they mean.
It's a bit late tonight. Hang on, I'll ask him. Do you think you're going to shoot anyone tomorrow?
Well, I don't know.
He says he doesn't know.
How the fuck do I know? Sarah?
Yeah, it tends to be people we know.
Sarah?
Try. Okay. Bye.
Can you smell burning?
Oh, bloody pan. I left the bloody pan on.
What?
What?
The pan is all over the place.
Really?
Everything's going up. I didn't know paint would burn.
Yeah. The gloss stuff's made of oil.
The whole room's going up.
Well, you'd better come back here, love. The smoke's really acrid.
Kitchen looks quite nice on fire.
Hmm. I wonder if it's gone up to the boys' room.
Yeah.
I'll give Mike a call. Yeah, Mike? Sorry to call during the match. Yeah. Listen, you couldn't just crane your neck out of the window and see if we've got a fire upstairs. The boys' room. Yeah? Wow. I thought I heard banging. No, well, we've got locks on all the windows. Yeah. Okay. Hey, Mike. Sorry about Lucy. I just saw her at the garage and smoked the bitch. Yeah, I know. I'll try. All right. Cheers. Boys have had it, love.
Oh, that's a shame. They're really looking forward to Christmas.
We won't see them in the school play now.
Do you think we should try and get them out?
No, that'd be too far gone by the sound of it.
Yeah, and the kids at school would be pretty foul to them, those burns.
We're just gonna have to get used to it being just the two of us again.
Unless we want some more.
What?
asking too much of my vacant smile and my laugh and lies that bring them. But as the stars are going out and this stage is full of nothing and the friends have all but gone, for my life, my God, I'm singing. We'll take our hearts outside, leave our lives behind. I'll watch the stars go out. We'll take our hearts outside, leave our lives behind. I'll watch the stars go out. Asking too much of my favorite friends to take these songs for real. Is it asking too much of my partner's hands to take these songs for real? But as the stars are going out and this stage is full of nothing,
Dubstar from, let's see, that was from 1986 from an album called Goodbye, and of course 1996 was a big year, a big heady summer when the European Championships of Soccer was held in England and Britpop was riding high and I guess Dubstar were in the charts. Okay, started off the show with Moloko. They had an album in 95 called Do You Like My Tight Sweater, and that was Party Weirdos. I'm never sure how you pronounce either the band name Moloko or of course the lead singer Rosen Murphy or Roisin. How do you pronounce that? As long as it doesn't sound too close to Raisin, then that's fine. In the middle was an excerpt from Chris Morrissey's Blue Jam from 98, and you know, he's basically a comedian, I guess, a writer, performer, comedian from the UK. That was a radio show which later was made into a disc that came out on Warp Records called Blue Jam. He's probably better known for his TV show Brass Eye, which has got a great distinction of being the third most complained about television show after... let's see if I can remember this. Yeah, after the 2007 Celebrity Big Brother or something, which had tons of racial bullying in it. And I don't remember what the most complained about thing was. I'm going to have to go and look that up. Something ridiculous. Okay, here's some Alex Gopher. It's called Time. You can never get too much on your hand. Time flies when you're having fun. Oh, hey. Time is money, time is costly science.
Station WTICK, as in TikTok, baby. What time is it?
What time is it?
Time is money. Time is the essence. Time molds our perspective, controls our
destiny. What time is it?
Fashionably late for the ball. Got my money in my pocket, so I'm the man. Why?
Susie and a thin man found me in the park. I was walking slowly round the pond and making the bones in my nose tickle by hooting. Susie said my mother had tipped her off after hearing my voice while throwing stones at the ducks. I'd been there a day and a half. It's because of my job, I explained. Susie looked doubtful. Batch testing new age CDs. But Hal said he didn't hire you in the end, she said. That would explain why he hasn't paid me. The thin man with Susie coughed up a small laugh and spat it onto the ground. You'd better come to dinner on Saturday, she said. Clive will be there too. She squeezed the man's arm. Clive is the suicide journalist. He was ghostly pale with black hair and a sad wit in his eyes. I'd say he looked like John Cusack, if I could remember who the hell John Cusack was. As he gazed moodily at the pond, Susie explained that Clive had announced in his weekly column that he had 6 months to live. On April the 15th, he would be committing suicide, and until then, he would write about how it felt to be staring death in the face. Clive took out a notebook and mumbled something about the blackness of a moorhen. Do you know what month it is now? She asked. I thought it might be Martober. Susie dabbed a damp eye and said that the suicide column was the saddest, funniest, most tragic and uplifting thing she'd ever read. He has just 12 weeks to go. I looked across the pond and started honking again. Susie turned to collect Clive, who was puffing on 3 cigarettes and smirking at his notes. 8 or late with a good excuse, she crooned, and popped a sweet in my mouth. I arrived well after dark. A smart woman opened the door. I couldn't afford a bottle of wine, I said, so I've drawn a picture of one on some cardboard. I'd prepared for the party by eating half a jar of instant coffee I'd found in the bins at Sainsbury's. She took my cardboard and said, "That's brilliant. Could I use you in a program?" When I asked her what sort of program, she said, "I could make a whole series about the things people bring to parties." "What do you do?" I said, thinking of the window at Dixon's. "My name's Hosanna Bell. I work in the warm arts." We stepped past Susie's yachting gear and into the dining room. 7 people sat noisily round a large bowl of oysters, but Susie wasn't a single one of them. I thought I was at the wrong party until they explained that the whole point was to be late, but with a good excuse. "Why are you late?" they asked. I said I'd had no money for a bottle of wine, and the homeless bloke at the tube station, who usually subs me a couple of quid because he says I look worse off than his dog, was being mugged when I asked him this time and hadn't given me a penny. And then I'd got lost because I'd forgotten whether Susie's house was directly opposite some trees or directly opposite no trees at all. Several conversations had started by the time I got to that beat. Susie arrived with great squeals and kisses. She revealed that she had spent the last 3 hours in bestial congress with a junior cabinet minister. Gobs hung open because everyone had thought he was gay, and several of them also knew that he was her half-brother. She wore a grin as big as a harbour. "Do you think Clive is still coming?" said a sincere man in glasses, and the talk turned at once to his column. Hosanna Bell said she had seen more truth in Clive's writing than the entire works of any writer she could think of. A woman called Emma agreed. "I'm still reeling. I don't know whether to weep, laugh, throw up, or hug everybody." "That's just your protein rush," observed a man called Paddy, pointing to the 17 shells on her plate. Emma touched his leg. Paddy was Clive's editor and was busy milking the table by mildly deprecating the praise for Clive's column, so that people doubled it in protest. He was just declaring that the columns would have to be polished up for the book when swearing in the hall announced the arrival of Clive. He looked a bit drunk and seemed small with his coat off. He said he was sorry he was late, but actually he didn't give a fuck. Everyone laughed, except Paddy. Susie said, "This brilliant man has asked me if you would all take it easy on the suicide questions tonight," and helped him liberally to bivalves. We nodded, of course, and I asked him if he thought oysters could commit suicide. Susie glared at me. I said I was just wondering if an oyster could make a decision like that, and if so, how it would die, because it couldn't really hang itself. "Are you being weird or sarcastic?" said Emma. I didn't know, because I get the two feelings mixed up. She called me a plankton and started telling Clive about the time she had cut her wrists. "Look at my scars," she said. "They are beautiful, but not as beautiful as your columns." For some reason, Clive looked at me as he said, "Only the very ugly is truly beautiful. And if the printed word has any meaning, then it must come from the very edge of fucky bamboo-boo." There were titters. Paddy muttered something about Clive alienating his fans, but was cut off by Emma. "No, Clive has every right to be drunk. You are in masses of pain, Clive, and you are doing it for us." "Yes," agreed Hosanna. Clive asked her what the hell she knew. "In the warm arts, we're strong on people how," she said. "What you have done in volunteering to take your own life, Clive, is illuminate with poignant resonance the self-destructor in all of us." There was a ripple of applause. Clive, who had been sousing his oysters in vodka and setting them alight before hurling them down his throat, now added a cigarette to the turmoil and belched the word bollocks. Paddy banged the table and started telling Clive that if all he could do was get pissed and shove drugs up his bum for the last 12 columns, then he would lose all his priceless empathy. "This is the finest copy I've ever commissioned," he said, "and I'm not having it ruined by some jumped-up little floozy going all diddums." A man called Stitt said that Paddy was threatening the purity of Clive's columns. If he uses the bottle, then that should come through in his work. "But he'll end up writing about you lot," said Paddy. Suddenly, all the guests were telling Clive about the time they'd nearly topped themselves. Hosanna Bell described how she'd been suicidal for 6 months after giving birth, until she decided to sue her baby for what it had done to her figure. Clive was insulting everyone and writing notes on his cuffs. "Losers, crap attempt," he shouted. "I want something that actually works." Someone said hosepipes work. Clive knew a bloke in a garden centre in Maidstone who actually cuts them to length for your particular car. He said the people carry a length hose was the most popular. "Wow," said Hosanna Bell, now also scribbling feverishly. "What about you?" Susie nudged me in the back. My head was below the table trying to lick an oyster off my corduroys. "Have you ever tried to kill yourself?" A great pustule of dread burst silently between my ears. I looked at Susie, and I knew that she wanted me to tell the story of how my prescription had been stolen last month, and I had in fact tried to kill myself. She had that look in her eye that said, "If you don't, I will." I stared back, trying to say no, but she was off about how I had tried to gas myself, but I couldn't find a tube long enough to get the exhaust into the car. She said she'd found me sitting on the curb next to a Vauxhall Nova with a yard of hose running from its exhaust pipe to my mouth, waiting for the owner to come back and start the engine. Everyone round the table was roaring with laughter. "I wish you hadn't told that story, Susie," I mumbled. She looked puzzled. "I only asked you a question," she said. "No, you didn't. You just told them about me trying to gas myself with a Vauxhall Nova." Everybody laughed again. "Tell us," they said. "Do tell us what happened." Clive looked at me now as if he knew that the black ink in my brain had started to boil. I dived back to my oyster. "So then, Mr. Superstar," Paddy was saying, "what is the best way to kill yourself?" Clive said that, in fact, the best way he knew was to buy 200 foot of nylon rope, tie one end round your neck, the other round a lamppost, and get into your car and floor the accelerator. He said that's how his great-uncle had done it. He'd made Clive help him. He was just 9 years old, and he'd had to ride in the car and stop it crashing when his uncle's head came off. The blood had made the pedals very slippery. Clive blinked smarting eyes. The table fell silent. "Really?" said Paddy, genuinely shocked. "Of course not, you moron," brayed Clive, and went on to explain that we were all idiots. He could say anything and we'd lap it up, just because we thought his pain meant something. Now, we wouldn't give him a second thought if he wasn't going to kill himself, except that actually he wasn't anyway, because the whole thing was a hoax, and he was going to say so in his column next week. Paddy erupted and decked Clive with the oyster bowl. Then he stood over him, roaring that this was his fucking idea. Clive had agreed to do it, and he wasn't going to wriggle out of killing himself now. Not now there was a book. Clive crawled from the room. The general opinion was that Clive had just treated us to his most savage and moving cry for help yet. We had all underestimated his pain. "I feel choked up now," said Emma, "but if I read about it next week, I'll be crying for the rest of the year. Someone bring me a fucking fag." Clive's voice sounded glutinous. Susie gestured to me as everyone else was still debating the meaning of his actions. He lay on the floor, two regurgitated oysters a tongue's length from his leaking mouth, one of them still slightly alive. His nose seemed a better place for the cigarette. The caustic fumes revived him sharply, and he stumbled to his feet. I'm going out, he said. I'm going to break into a car and drive round drunk until I crash. As he lunged past me into the hall, his foot snagged on a rope among Susie's boat bags, and he fell on the seagrass. We both looked at the large coil of blue nylon. Are you good at knots? He said. Susie's car keys were hanging by the front door. You might as well use the discovery, I said. She'll be so thrilled to have a new story. About an hour later, I revealed that Clive hadn't just gone for a walk. He'd gone to divorce his head, and how I'd helped him with the keys and the knots. I needed to go to sleep, and had correctly anticipated that Paddy would punch my lights out.
Listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
Hello, Vancouver. This is Carolyn Mark. You're listening to CITR 101.9 on your FM dial.
Hi, this is Audie from Broken Bones, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And all I'm going to say to you is fuck off and die. Ah!
Okay, hello, I'm Tim, again, Sarah Lepp, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
I'm at war. I'm at war with myself, I'm at war with you, I'm at war with everybody. That's why I don't do drugs, because I don't want to be numb. I want to feel the pain. I want the clarity of the challenge. I want to win. I want to kick in the head. I want to tear the throat box out. I want to smash in the lungs. I want to kick in the rib cage. I want to split the spine. And I want to use your phone, make love to your wife, sister, eat your dog, and leave your house with a good cassette.
CITR 101.9 FM, where there's just a little bit of Kim Fowley in each and every one of us.
No. I don't think so.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Toast rack. I don't want my body, so God give me another one. You can have this one back. The same old body. Oh.
always in the same old club. Always the same old finger, sticking up the same old nose. Wake up in the morning, it's the same body lying there. The same teeth and toenails, the same old skin and hair. To change it, it's ruined through late night dissipation. You can't build a mansion on a shaky foundation. I don't want my body, it's either too hot or it's too cold. In the evening it feels young and clumsy, in the morning it feels baggy and cold. Oh, I don't want my body.
Because if you know people trampled you, and if you get trampled and people just take a hat, people take advantage of you.
Can I make Friday like a stagger? No, show every single one of them that I'm not daffy. So...
See, if somebody speaks to you, they're angry. You can't help it. Staying there's running about these areas.
Nothing ever helped,
mate. See, she's
you've got to.
Line. You've got to.
You've got to. Line. Not if you should go up. Company I pushed her harder.
You couldn't meet anybody any nicer if you stopped drinking. It's like chopping cheese. I don't really think that I could live without me. Sitting in my sister's one night, my sister was blind. And the waitress was drinking. And it was a daft that I'd been searched or something. My sister was in the window. So he lifted this. It was me. Bottles, a glass of bottles of drink we had. Started smash ran off of my head, so I left it ran and smashed both his head. He left it ran and smashed both my head. My sister's got this blazer, and she used to bottle for bottle running in his head, but smashed him. Her face was covered in glass. It was unreal. When I think back to the things that happened to bring you, it's funny now, but it wasn't funny at the time.
I'm then drunk. My friend's gone to a mall bar and heard that. I took my trip down. Fucked my trip. What was that? Fucking John, that went down. Man, him, I know. He rapped me. He was putting me down and he got in there, I know.
Christopher was in here and left and went out along to Cam's drunk and said, ah, just...
No, he walked out like that. I just
shagged Mad and Bob. Right, and he swore in Cam's kid's life. And then see, after it, he admitted the truth that he hadn't. So Christopher's finito with me. So yeah, I'm finished with him all. They told me I'd make a choice, so I made my choice. That's me and my speaking to my mum.
We've spoken,
take it out. That's
I'll love it up again.
My choice, we're getting engaged. But that's engaged for me, but I've not got a ring yet.
He's swore that he's picked me out of the valley and all sorts of shit. He swore down on everything that he would never, ever, ever lost a horn to me again.
I see a face from the past.
cause there's a ring on your finger.
I'm in you. And as the days pass, I'm in you more and more.
La 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 la.
always hate to not play this track right to the very end. But, you know, and it's 15-minute long glory. It's quite something, and I don't think we're going to have time for that because it's almost 6 o'clock, which means I got to get out of the chair and make way for Heather for Queer FM. But this is the Poustics with the track I'm In You from an album called The Great White Wonder, which I think was in about 1994 or something that this album came out. And, you know, a 15-minute long track, but I don't think it can be really judged by the usual standards of most songs because it's really more of a pastiche, really, of realized and unrealized influences and the whole idea of nicking from places. Of course, the title I Am In You is taken from